Welcome back to the National Cancer Prevention Workshop, produced each year by the organization LessCancer.org. We are continuing our John Dingell Cancer Health Disparities and Access interviews. And today we're talking about some causes of cancer, which you may not be as familiar with. Joining us is Dr. Gregory C. Townsend. He is an infectious disease specialist at the University of Virginia Medical Center. And Dr. Townsend, first of all, good to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, great. Well, I know people are familiar with the genetic causes of cancer as well as the environmental factors, whether it's smoking or drinking or putting on sunscreen. There is a whole host of infectious agents which cause cancer. First of all, is there, just so maybe I wasn't paying enough attention, but is there growing awareness of these infectious agents and their connections to cancer?
Yeah, I certainly think that, in the world of infectious diseases, we've been aware of many of these connections for a long time, but I think it's becoming more apparent to the general population that there is a connection between some cancers and or between some infections and some cancers, and that there's an increasing interest in researching possible connections between the two fields.
So let's talk about what's actually kind of under the hood here. Is it as simple as infections, can create inflammation or compromise your immunities, or is there some sort of chemical way an infection can actually trigger cancerous cells, or is it all of the above?
All of the above. That's a great question, Miles. So in some cases, an example would be hepatocellular carcinoma. So we know that hepatitis C and hepatitis B viruses, which affect the liver, can lead to hepatocellular carcinoma, but it doesn't look like in those circumstances that the viruses are causing like a genetic transformation in the liver cells that causes the cancer. It appears that it's inflammation in the liver, when there's this constant stream of degradation and reconstitution of the cells, which leads to increasing likelihood for mutations to occur, and that's what causes the cancer. Compare that to the case of human papillomavirus and both genital cancer, so cervical cancer, vulvar cancer, penile cancer, and now it's one of the more common causes of esophageal cancer. And in that case, it appears that it actually is the virus that is causing a genetic transformation in the cells that leads to the cancer. So it can be either mechanism that is occurring.
So it's complicated, but it seems like this is the kind of thing that if you're screening for the initial infection well and treating it, this can nip a potential cancer in the bud, or is that too simplistic to say?
Oh, absolutely. That's why we do cervical cancer screening, right? We are looking for changes that suggest that these cells are infected with human papillomavirus, and we can actually do a genetic analysis to look for specific strains of the human papillomavirus that are associated with cancer. And if we find that there are evidence that suggests that the cells are infected with the human papillomavirus, carcinogenic strains, then we can take the steps appropriate to try to get rid of the tissue that is infected. So screening is absolutely essential to try to reduce the likelihood that someone is infected with one of these cancer-causing viruses. Can then reduce their risk of developing cancer.
And of course, in the case of HPV, there is a vaccine as well. So
this
is a case where a vaccine could prevent cancer in a sense.
Yeah, the first and only cancer preventing vaccine. I just think that's a huge step in medical progress. So we have a vaccine against cancer is just tremendous.
And yet, I believe, what is it? The numbers are they about 70% who receive the vaccine? Okay. That's not good enough, is it?
It is not. No, it's not great. There are certainly many reasons that people may defer deliberately getting the vaccine, often for religious reasons. But there also, unfortunately, are social determinants of health that may restrict someone's access to the vaccines. And so we have individuals who are at risk for developing these cancers who shouldn't be because, you know, vaccines are available.
Yeah, I believe there are more than 300,000 women a year who die of this the world over. I think a woman dies every 2 minutes of this, which is just, it's completely preventable. And I know as much of a problem as it is here in places like sub-Saharan Africa, it's really a huge challenge to get the word out, isn't it? Because there's so many mores and stigmas associated with this one.
Right. Yeah. You know, and people have used the excuse is that if you give someone the human papillomavirus vaccine, well, that's just going to encourage them to engage in sex because now that they don't have to worry about, you know, getting cancer, which is just, it's a specious argument. And it's a frustrating one to have to try to counter. But again, there also are problems with, you know, cancer or rather vaccine delivery, particularly in areas of resource limited areas, both, you know, abroad and in this country.
Let's talk a little bit about HIV and cancer. In this case, you have a compromised immune system. Is that the real root cause that leads to problems with cancer with HIV?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, we are protected from cancers by our immune surveillance system. You know, probably most of us at any one time have some cancer cell pop up here and there, and our immune systems, you know, recognize it and attack it and get rid of it before it can cause any problems. But with HIV, our immune systems aren't, you know, people have advanced disease, immune systems aren't working as well as they do. They don't have the capacity for performing adequate immune surveillance. And so when a cancer cell pops up, it has time to gain a foothold and to, you know, multiply and divide and to form a malignancy that can cause a problem. So one of the things that we are very aware of in HIV care, and, you know, there are certain cancers that sort of associated with HIV, like the Kaposi sarcoma and, you know, cervical cancer, which are much more common in people with HIV. But the reality is that almost every cancer is more common in people with HIV than it is in the rest of the population.
Boy, talk about, you know, collateral damage to a horrible disease already. So has anybody, I presumably you would know this, the number of infectious agents, we're talking viruses, bacteria, parasites, tallied up the number and the number of cancers that are connected? Is it a bigger number than we think?
So in the human population, there actually aren't a lot of infectious diseases or infectious agents that are strongly associated with cancers. There are a few that we have talked about. There are actually many more in the animal world. One of the first evidence of viruses causing cancer came from animal studies looking at a sarcoma virus. But there are sarcoma viruses in the human population that can cause sarcomas, which are soft tissue viruses. So there aren't a lot of, you know, it's not in the millions, but there's certainly, you know, enough to be problematic.
So is there an issue of public awareness here? Do people need to be more dialed into how these infectious agents can lead to, you know, much more serious consequences potentially?
Yeah. And again, I think one of the important messages here is that, you know, we can do something about this. So again, the case we talked about, cervical cancer, and how it's so very, very important to get screening. And I should mention, you know, not just cervical cancer, but also anal cancer. It's important to get screening for that for people who are at risk from HPV associated cancers, but also things like, you know, hepatitis B and hepatitis C. There are an estimated 1.5 million people in this country who have hepatitis C infection who don't know that they have it. And this is a disease that, if left untreated, and we've got, you know, we have treatments that are 97% effective. We don't have a lot of treatments available for anything that are 97% effective, but we can get rid of this virus, done, gone, killed 97% of the time. there's no reason anybody should be walking around with hepatitis C in this day and age. It is, you know, encouraged that people who are in certain risk groups get screened, and we should be doing that. We should be emphasizing them. And if someone feels like they might may be at risk, they should be talking to their healthcare provider saying, I need to get a test for hepatitis C. I want to make sure that, if I know that I have it, I get treated for it.
Yeah, almost everything you mentioned here, or frequently, there are, great ways to stop this. And as you say, for whatever reason, whether it's just lack of knowledge or stigmas or whatever, we're not getting there. That's particularly poignant, particularly when you're in your line of work, to hear that, I imagine.
Yeah, it's an interesting, my field is specialty is infectious diseases. And one of the things that is very clear to all of us in this field is that infectious diseases tend to be diseases that disproportionately affect people in marginalized groups, people who are poor, people who have poor access to healthcare for a number of reasons, some of which may be social stigma or economic issues, and that sort of, as a cross-section of individuals with cancer as well, that these tend to be more common among individuals in resource-limited settings, individuals who have difficulty accessing healthcare, and not just more common, but unfortunately have increasing morbidity and mortality related to the cancers in those groups.
Well, we've got to figure out a way to make healthcare more accessible to broader numbers of people in this country. We have such tremendous wealth in this country. It's kind of stunning to me that this happens.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the more frustrating things that I have to deal with on a regular basis, is that we have the best healthcare system in the world. I have no doubts about that. What we have problems with is getting people access to it. And again, there are so many reasons that people may not have access to the healthcare system that we have. And that's in this, the 21st century, there's no reason for that.
Agreed. And I want to shift gears slightly. I know infectious disease is your main day job, but you also are the associate dean for diversity at the medical school there. And I know one of the issues when you get into the issue of screening and prevention is the issue of prostate cancer, and in particular among African-American men. Disproportionate numbers of them face prostate cancer. Yeah. Do we know enough about why that is yet?
Well, so there's probably a genetic component to it. But I think there is also, again, there are problems with access to screening that may lead to the development of prostate cancer in individuals who might not otherwise have developed it. And then, as I just mentioned, that individuals, blacks who do develop prostate cancer are more likely to die from prostate cancer than are whites in this country. Social determinants of health, it's interesting. I mean, I'm so very glad that healthcare personnel who've been trained today are being taught about social determinants of health, because they are so very important. I just saw a slide not very recently that showed sort of the breakdown of how different factors affect our healthcare, our health rather. And only about 10% was genetics, and about 10% was medical care, and the rest was social determinants. That's where we need to be focusing our attention. That's a very, very fixable problem.
Was this overlooked for a long time? And if so, why do you think that was?
Yeah, I was giving a lecture to some visiting fourth year students about social determinants of health a couple of weeks ago. And I told them, when I was in medical school, which, it was a while ago, but within the last century, I literally never heard the phrase social determinants of health. I don't remember ever anybody talking about how, you know, where someone lived, how much money they made, their education, how any of that affected their health. So, things have changed, I think, for the better in terms of the education that our healthcare trainees are getting. I think we have a lot of work to do in terms of actually addressing the problem. There's an Institute of Medicine monograph that came out almost 20 years ago now called Unequal Treatment, where they looked at a number of different domains of health and tried to figure out, you know, why it is that there was a disparity in health between Blacks and whites in this country. And the conclusion was, even if you take into account socioeconomic status, there are still these disparities. So there's something about how people are being treated in the healthcare system that is leading to these disparities in health.
Well, I guess, you know, the first step is acknowledging the problem. So maybe we've taken that first step, but there is a long road ahead, isn't there?
Yeah. And, you know, again, I think there are a lot of people who are looking at this and thinking hard about it. Frankly, the Affordable Care Act was a huge step in the right direction because it gave, you know, tens of millions of people greater access to healthcare that they wouldn't have had otherwise. But we still have a lot of people who are uninsured, underinsured, or live in areas where they have difficulty getting access to healthcare. We have a profound shortage of primary care providers in this country who act as, you know, the gateway to make sure that people are getting the health care that they need. So we have a lot of work to do to, you know, make the promise of the best healthcare system in the world work for everybody.
That's the fundamental irony there, isn't it? It is the best healthcare system in the world, just not for everybody. And the inequalities of that, We shouldn't allow that. We shouldn't allow that to continue, should we?
No, we really shouldn't. And, you know, obviously there are forces at play here that are, you know, above your and my pay grade, that are, you know, working on both sides, you know, some trying to make sure that we have better access, and some who feel like, you know, we'll let the forces of economics play out and hope for the best. Let's, you know, hope everybody gets better. It's working.
I don't know that we can ever have a system that is for profit and still is patient centric. I think those things probably are difficult to reconcile.
I think they're impossible to reconcile. I don't see how you can have a system that is built on, you know, because the insurance is built to not give out money. They don't want to have to give people money. That's, they lose money by doing that. So a system that is built on an insurance, private insurance system, is not going to be providing the best care for anybody. Well, except for those who have a lot of money, can afford the best private insurance.
You've hit the nail on the head. Then that's pretty much it in a nutshell, isn't it? I mean, it's a big, complicated story, but that really is it, isn't it?
Yeah. And I, you know, can't tell you about the struggles I've had with insurance companies recently about, you know, trying to get, it took me 3 months to get one of my patients an antibiotic because their insurance company didn't want to pay for it. And I tried to point out to them over and over again, look, you're either going to pay for this antibiotic, or you're going to pay for the hospitalization. You decide.
But that's the system we have. We don't believe in prevention, right? We wait until the house is on fire.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know that we've solved any problems, but we certainly highlighted them. And I guess talking about them is part of it. So
Raising awareness is the first step. And again, I think it's very important for people to understand that we have these issues and that we have solutions to the issues.
Dr. Greg Townsend is an infectious disease specialist at the University of Virginia Medical Center. And I thank you very much for your time and for joining us on the John Dingell Cancel Health Disparities and Access interviews this year. And keep up the good work, will you?
Thank you again. And again, thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Our pleasure.